Welcome to the Command Line Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. For my listeners in the U.S., this coming week marks Thanksgiving. I'm pretty grateful that I still have this show going. I'm pretty grateful that you all are still listening. And despite some of the hardship that I went through this past year, I'm actually grateful for a lot of the experiences that I went through. I see them now with the benefit of hindsight and a little bit of perspective as opportunities for growth, both personally and professionally. And I look forward to continuing to grow in the coming year. To lead off the discussion of the news stories that caught my attention this week, some that I am following up on. First, in the wake of the horrible attacks of about 2 weeks ago in Paris, and some of the attacks even before that, but I think Paris is what really catalyzed this, we've seen a couple of really bad reactions both in the UK and here in the US. David Cameron is trying to push forward the Snoopers Charter. Now, I talked about this, that the bill had actually been revealed, and it was as bad as we thought. I'll link here to a little bit of follow-up analysis from Cory Doctorow on Boing Boing, who does a really good job of following these issues, and really points out some of the key costs should this go through in the height of emotion without pushback, compromise, and adequate debate. And here it would end security research in the UK. It basically would make that effectively tantamount to an illegal activity, and this is a very critical point. It may seem like a bit of a stretch. It may seem unimportant that academics are able to examine secure technology, but if they don't, there is a presumption that we'll be secure in some way, and this just doesn't follow. If legal actors are not able to scrutinize the technology that helps keep our communications online secure, There's nothing stopping bad actors from undertaking that scrutiny. So we really need people interested in the defense and well-being of good actors to be safe to do so. It would also add additional costs to internet access because of the requirements that would have to go in for ISPs and other access providers. It would most notoriously beg backdoors be added into software. Problem here, of course, is that the presumption, again, flawed presumption, like with the security research, is that only good actors would utilize those backdoors. Backdoors don't care who uses them. If they're there, if someone knows that they're there, it's just a function of time before a bad actor gains access through them. So we really shouldn't be trying to differentially degrade our security software, our security technology, because it isn't differential. It degrades it for everyone. Here in the U.S., the bad response has evolved beyond attacks on the technology itself to actually trying to interfere with websites and social media. So rather than baking in certain capabilities for law enforcers, the ability to effectively shut things off. This was brought up a while ago as the notional internet kill switch, and it was preposterous at that time, and it really remains preposterous now. It would just, as with the Snoopers Charter, add unknown but significant costs across the board to everybody trying to access and get online. It would cause untold harms to innocent communication. And even worse, in here, if you read into this article by John Brodkin that I'll include in the show notes from Ars Technica, Barton's also talking about expanding CALEA. This is a problematic law as it stands. And it's predicated, again, on a pretty gross misconception that weakness can be baked into communication tools that only good or authorized actors can utilize. So it has that in common with the Snoopers Charter. And there has been a lot, and I think rightly so, push from the public interest sector to try to reform CALEA or defang it because of this problem that it has now. So pouring gasoline on that fire is definitely something that we don't want to see happen in the height of emotion, as horrific as recent events may have been. The next story I have some new developments to discuss is the one that finished up last week's episode. This was about the allegations that Carnegie Mellon University had turned over, in exchange for private funding, research on breaking Tor. Carnegie Mellon has responded, first of all, and the response is fundamentally rather vague. They don't exactly say that they didn't do anything. They mention a subpoena, and that's about it. Now, the chief technologist over at the ACLU, Chris Segoyan, responded to this on Twitter and noted, based on his expertise, that a subpoena does not mean the same thing as a gag order, and it's very rare for a subpoena to be served with a gag order. So there really isn't anything here if we believe that their research was turned over in response to a legal order of that kind. There's nothing that would prevent them from just saying very explicitly and very clearly here what it is that they did or didn't do. They're refuting that the work was paid for. They're saying that this was at legal request, and that's about it. But if you read this article at Threat Post by Michael Mimosa that I'll link to in the show notes, you'll see that the response, such as it is quite short and profoundly vague. In response to last week's story, Tor is focusing in on some improvements, an upgrade to how they handle, in particular, the connections at the edge, the exit nodes. Actually, I think not necessarily the exit nodes, but on the other side where the client is first connecting. Normally, as this article at Extreme Tech explains by Graham Templeton, a client is connecting to a handful of nodes, and this is, I think, just to help optimize traffic and get a little bit better throughput, a little more consistent with the experiences that folks have with regular internet access. The problem is, in choosing a larger set that might admit a malicious actor, a bad node. So the research here is apparently the improvements that they're looking into are to limit that exposure, presumably, especially if there's a capability or a coming capability to pin to more trusted nodes that would potentially increase the security of Tor. As I said, this could be just part of what Tor has done pretty much from its inception, to continue to respond to research, to things that they find on their own, to improve the assurances that the technology gives to those who use it. Could also be a direct response to the research in question. We don't know, as that research hasn't been presented, and I'm not sure I've seen an analysis of explicitly what makes up the attack that was uncovered by CMU. I'll add that I'm a little troubled that Templeton characterizes Tor as a laughingstock in the security community. Now, it's been a year since I moved in circles that were also inhabited by some of the Tor developers, and I would say that my impression is Tor actually was considered one of the more respected and trustworthy projects in the space, that they struggled very much to keep working on issues as they came up, as I described, to keep the tool working in the way that they wanted to, and to be very transparent about both the benefits that Tor could provide, as well as very clearly the limitations of the technology, the things that you shouldn't use it for because it's not designed or suitable for that. So I'm not really sure where he gets off saying that or in what community this is considered to be the case, but I will just say that I'm glad, regardless of such sort of almost ad hominem characterization of the project, that they are working to improve the technology, and hopefully they'll continue to do so as they have done well into the future. As a technologist, as a professional technologist, I love technology. I really love playing with it. I have all my life, as I say in the lead into this podcast, I'm a lifelong hacker, clearly have a passion for it. As a user, I hate technology. It rarely works as we expect. It breaks at the most inopportune times. I was thrilled to read a really nice piece on Locust by Cory Doctorow this week, who talks about, actually he expands on a law that Anil Dash coined: three things never work: voice chat, printers, and projectors. And he uses those as good prods in the rest of the article to talk about his own personal experiences going back even to the late 70s of how these technologies are broken, but then more critically, why that breakage occurs, that it's actually not inherent in the technology. It really is the pattern of usage, the expectations that we build up. If something works well, it's not enough for us to dwell on it working well. We always stretch beyond that to the next use, to push things beyond what they can do today to look at the kinds of things they unlock and enable going forward. I really like this because I think it communicates a really nice fingertip feel for a common experience that I have and that I see amongst regular users around me, that technology should be more stable, it should be more capable, it should be more reliant, and it's not. And I think that this is clever in that, again, as I said, it's not the nature of technology as we crafted. It's not a failure in the crafting of technology. It is how we use it, the demands we place on it. And I think that's something good to be mindful of in terms of maybe tempering some of that frustration to get a sense of maybe we are pushing a little harder. Maybe there are some ways to relent under critical circumstances to use a little bit less of the advanced capabilities, at least to have some better understanding when our phones reboot, our systems crash, when we can't print, project, or chat over the internet, why that may be so. As reluctant as I have been to weigh in on Adpocalypse, I have tracked some of the antecedents of this for a while. I wanted things like P3P, which was a user proactive sort of privacy, declarative privacy contract mediated by technology to work. Do not track is kind of the latter day watered down implementation of that. The problem with it being that there really isn't any sort of transparent individual accountability. You can't tell when a server is not honoring the do not track directives that you configure in your browser. And there's no enforcement. Where do you go to even if you were able to uncover that? I was feeling a little mixed about this article at TechDirt, which otherwise I think follows these issues quite well. I do think fundamentally the write-up here by Carl Bode about the FCC's decision to not respond to a petition to enforce do not track, I think ultimately was the right decision, as he says, that it's a good thing. The problem is that this is just a mess. It's not clear how this would play out. It's not clear that the FCC has the legislative or regulatory authority to do this. And I think the unintended consequences are especially hard to tease out, to understand if they did start enforcing this very sort of vague and broad do not track, that as we know from other cases where I think the vagueness is on the side opposite of consumers, that overbroad and vague is generally a bad thing. So hopefully out of this, out of discussions of this, out of the Adpocalypse, we'll see some better discussions about how to expose contracts that are clearer and more enforceable, how to build up expectations, perhaps how to build up tooling, maybe new business models, any number of things. But I think this is important to bear in mind too, that we are very careful not to take any missteps, the cost of recovering from which might be, catastrophic is probably overstating it, but higher than we might like. Speaking of possible technology-based remediations for overbroad tracking and snooping, Clive Thompson at Wired had an interesting piece predicated on some research and some tech work done by and at the behest of Helen Nissenbaum that falls under this category that he explains pretty well in the piece. I encourage you to take a look, called obfuscation. The idea is, and he likens this to anti-radar techniques in military action, so chaff, throwing out things into the environment to make them more noisy and harder for an attacker to tease a signal out on a valid target. In this instance, what he describes are a couple of tools that do things like generate a whole proliferation of search queries while you're searching for something you're actually interested in, to make it harder for somebody trying to build up a behavioral profile to understand exactly what it is that you might be doing when interacting with the search engine. And then also just making a lot of extraneous requests when browsing around normally from link to link. Again, trying to make it harder to understand the actual path that you take from page to page, site to site when going around the internet. Now, this idea at its core is interesting. It's something that doesn't require a lot of skill. It doesn't look like it was particularly difficult to implement this, took much time to do it. There are a couple of reservations I have with this technique, though, that generating noise is actually hard. It's trying to do something truly random that would defy the kinds of big data analysis and pattern recognition that advertisers and others interested in these kinds of insights and gleanings that they have at their disposal. That's tough. And I'm skeptical that something developed in a couple of months would be effective over the long term. This might then encourage a bit of a Red Queen's race, a one-upmanship that I don't think can lead to a good place. I'm a little concerned, too, that the techniques described here actually do involve some extra costs. They do require utilizing more bandwidth to pursue them, and not all means of accessing the internet are equal. There are still many places where the most effective way to get online for technical, social, or economic reasons is mobile, and we're still in a world where we're dealing with data caps on mobile, with throttling, with exorbitant costs, with things that would make this technique less viable, and especially in places where I think very often people who have that limited choice are most exposed and most need this kind of defense and protection. Regardless, I think we do need more creative options like this. We do need more people like Nissenbaum looking into ways that are not as incumbent on good actions by others like Do Not Track that end users can take for themselves to take back a little bit of control and more privacy, hopefully. As I mentioned at the outset, this coming week is the observance of Thanksgiving here in the U.S. One of the things that I'm routinely grateful for year after year, all the open source and free software projects in my life that help my professional work and help me just do the things that I'm passionate about in my spare time. I'm always glad to see discussion of ways to better support that. There was an interesting post that I picked up from Hacker News. An experiment by Open Whisper Systems called BitHub. Open Whisper Systems is one responsible for some of the latter-day, especially mobile-focused tooling to bring secure end-to-end communications to people that have need for it, like tools like Redphone and others. Here, they're talking about some of the problems with redistributing donations that come into a project. And the part of this that I think is clever is automating that distribution, having it be relatively egalitarian and based on the individual contributions of people working on a project rather than on reputation or some subjective sense of merit. The problem I have with this is it's predicated on Bitcoin, and I think that that precludes a lot of folks beyond the technically interested in supporting this. I do hope that, regardless of the reservations, that the novel aspects do encourage more experimentation in this space, because I think that especially for tools in the space that Open Whisper Systems makes, we do need more diverse funding. I think that's what we see with Tor, with CMU, with some other recent stories, rather than a few large funders that might have agendas that make it very difficult for open source and free software projects to inhabit tenable positions in their communities. To end on a positive note, Google's announced through its public policy blog, this is actually a post written by Fred von Lohmann, who used to work at Electronic Frontier Foundation before he went to Google a handful of years ago, that they're going to step forward and provide funding for the legal defense of certain key YouTubers on where there's a strong fair use basis for the work that they post on the site that might draw a complaint. Now, Cory Doctorow, who also linked to this on Boing Boing, points out that he thinks this might be a consequence of the recent victory in the so-called Dancing Baby, the Lens copyright suit, that finally came to, I think, a good conclusion a few weeks back. I have to ask, what more could Google do? Is this a function of time and place? Is it them trying to navigate internal resources and policies to do something outward? There's so much more that they could do beyond legal funding in terms of directly limiting harms of false claims in the first place, as supported by their DMCA takedown tool. Hopefully, though, as many have noted in their analysis, the case law that emerges from this, given the selectivity, and they're very careful to explain this balance that they can't defend everyone that has a fair use claim in a takedown case, but being very selective, that they actually can have a broader impact even if they're not able to fund the defense of everybody involved in such a situation. It remains to be seen, but I think that given Fred's track record at EFF, given how Google, in some instances, has struck pretty good balances, they have brought in a lot of good policy folks from the outside over the last few years. This is something worth watching, and I think that this is actually, despite some of the limitations, the reservations that I have, I think this is really, really good news and might start to speak to some sort of a sea change. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to record a bit of audio with your smart device and send it to the same place. Until next time, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.